In this season of light and carols and yearning for peace, there is a great deal of focus on a baby in a manger, wrapped as he was in swaddling clothes and shining with hope for all the world to see. But when we speak of the peace that was yearned for by the hungry people traveling far distances in ancient Galilee, when we speak of the peace yearned for by those in the Middle East today, and when we speak of the peace yearned for by all of those caught in the grip of oppression and warfare and violence throughout the span of human history, it isn't usually a peace of a silent night we're talking about, but the hard-earned peace that arises from the very midst of pain. The peace that ancient Galilee needed, the peace that the world needs today, is not just the peace of the infant Christ swaddled in his manger and glowing with heavenly angels. The peace that the world needs today is the peace of the grown, powerful man named Joshua, the son of Joseph, known to many as Jesus, who burst into the world 2,000 years ago and became for his friends and for history so much more than a contrived image of purity and cuteness. I've preached before about the historical Jesus, and the truth is that when you try to hunt down the evidence of the man and his life, the pickings are slim at best. If in fact a man called Joshua, the son of Joseph, really lived in ancient Galilee, he was a Jewish man who lived and died under Roman imperial rule. And he was given a traitor's death, crucified as an enemy of the state. That's really all that we know, or at least all that we can confirm from sources outside the Christian scriptures themselves. And yet, within that very basic framework of historical evidence, there are stories within the story, and every one of them, both the wide arc of this man's preaching and the many little worlds within worlds contained in each of his stories, all of it pointed to one goal: the destabilization of the status quo and the creation of a different kind of society. Change of the world, of an empire of domination that held its people under its thumb, change of hearts, change of systems, change of the way people thought about opposing violence, all of that was at the core of his message. And if one is willing, even just a little bit, to examine the texts of the Christian scriptures themselves, there are a few things that you start to see over and over again. For instance, it is a fact that the most common behavior Jesus evidences anywhere in the Gospels is dining with sinners and touching those who are dirty. The most common behavior evidenced anywhere in the Gospels is Jesus freeing himself to be with and among everything society says is unclean. Eating with prostitutes, washing of feet, touching dead people, it happens over and over again. Jesus thwarts purity and cleanliness. He thwarts everything society says is proper. And in their proper context, most of the morality tales that we have ascribed to this man we call Jesus actually have profound political and social statements underneath and in between the handy little morals we have ascribed to them. Yet in Christian America, these stories so often have been turned into little children's book versions of themselves. Things that have essentially been watered down to wishy-washy versions of the golden rule, be nice, everybody, ends up being the message we think Jesus preached, conveniently free of all those meddling political and social implications of the man's actual life. If our nation is the new Rome, as some among our leaders like to think, it's not so convenient that Jesus said everything he said and did everything he did under the thumb of oppressive Roman imperial rule. His were an ancient Middle Eastern people who long lived in subjugation to the dominant political forces of their time, and just about everything that his ministry meant was in that now inconvenient political context. One author, Richard Horsley, has said, "Trying to understand Jesus' speech and action without knowing how Roman imperialism determined the conditions of life in Galilee would be like trying to understand Martin Luther King without knowing how slavery, Reconstruction, and segregation determined the lives of African Americans in the United States." You cannot take his work and pull it out of its context. You cannot take his words and clean them up so that they're tidy and neat and handy and cute. There are all sorts of ways we can depoliticize Jesus. There are all sorts of ways we can clean him up. It's tempting for religious liberals like us to just make his message so comfortable that we claim Jesus didn't really judge anybody, that what he preached was a sort of hippie communal love. But whatever Jesus was or was not, all scholarship and even a reasonable reading of the text support the idea that his faith statements existed within a precise political context. His work was not accomplished in a vacuum, but alongside other followers and other leaders and an entire history of radical Jewish resistance to Roman imperial rule. And this man did judge, and often quite harshly. It's just that his judgment didn't fall on the people conservative evangelicals would have us believe. Instead, it fell squarely on the shoulders of the mighty, the powerful, the powers that be. It fell on those whose political proclivities looked suspiciously like our current empire, or any empire that preceded it. One of my very favorite scholars, Walter Wink. If there were a Walter Wink fan club, I would be like the president. He loves to bring up some of the most popular, easy-peasy, sort of isn't-this-comfy morality tales of Jesus and pull them apart so that we can remember their radical context again. When you think about the common understandings of, say, what it is to turn the other cheek, Jesus starts to look like a pretty passive person, doesn't he? Be peaceful. That's what that phrase has come down in history to mean. Sometimes it has even been twisted into a call to allow oneself to be wounded, because those wounds, those beatings that we receive at the hands of oppressors of all kinds might somehow be salvific. Get beat up for God. That's how people have interpreted that phrase. That's often what it seems like the life of Jesus is telling us to do. If someone hits you, turn the other cheek. If someone takes your coat, offer your shirt as well. And if you are pressed into carrying someone's pack for a mile just because you're so darn nice, carry it for two. Those are the aphorisms of Jesus we've heard again and again, red-lettered, notable, quotables, all of them. And every single one of them has been interpreted in such a way that anybody who followed them would come out of a conflict bruised, naked, and tired, without any actual change having taken place at all. These statements have all been made into rather empty platitudes of peacefulness that nobody in their right mind would actually follow until you look closer. And let's take a look at it. This is a stretch for our congregation, I know, but I have printed scripture in your order of service. So if you dig it out there, it's right underneath, "Let there be peace on earth." Matthew 5:38-42, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him your other also. And if someone wants to sue you and take your cloak, give him your tunic as well. And if someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. So let's dig deeper. This passage is a perfect example of what Walter Wink calls a remarkable turn in human development, of which Jesus is one of the most vocal advocates. He calls it a third way, a creative response to violence and oppression in which the oppressed person holds her ground while refusing to become a mirror of all the violence around her. It's really easy to mirror violence, isn't it? The jerk cuts you off in traffic and you feel your own foot press down a little harder on the gas. The guy in the next cubicle makes a cutting remark about your haircut, and suddenly you got lots of mean things to say about his tie. Iran builds up its nuclear capacity, and America hunkers down in its commitment to protect the world through our own nuclear armament. The natural, normal response that a person has when confronted with violence is to mirror the violence right back. It is the way of things. It is how we work. And this non-creative response to oppression is the source of more suffering in this world than I could ever name. Of course, there is another option. We could meet violence with non-resistance. When confronted with a drawn gun, we can say, well, I guess my party's over, and passively stand ourselves up against the wall to get shot. When Iran builds up its nuclear capacity, the rest of the world can say, cool, carry on then, guys. This is not a common practice among human beings, in large part because we are evolutionary creatures and evolution does not reward those who fail to resist their own destruction. Instead, those people are quite summarily destroyed. This text says, do not resist one who is evil, or do not resist the evil person. And it seems to be inviting us to non-resistance, to passivity, to doing nothing. But the catch, the part that turns all this around, that makes it so typically Jesus, is the fact that this passage is not accurately translated. The Greek word that is usually translated as resist in this passage is the word antisthenai. And here's where I'm going to get overly intellectual, so bear with me. It'll get more interesting, I promise. Those of you in the first service know it's about to get more interesting. So let's work with this word, antisthenai. This is the actual Greek word that has been translated as resist, do not resist. Anti means against. Stainai means stand, means to stand against somebody, to offer resistance. So do not antisthenai in a really oversimplified translation means do not stand against. But what's overlooked by the translators is that in the ancient Near East, antisthenai is a technical term for warfare. It refers to the marching of two armies in solid ranks until they collide in a deafening cacophony of steel against steel, until they stand there and disembowel one another until one side has had all it can take, and they break and run. Antisthenai is a technical term for bloody and brutal encounter. And so when Jesus says, do not antisthenai other people, he's not simply saying, don't resist them. Of course you resist those who are evil. Jesus always resisted evil. What he's saying is don't collide with them in bloody warfare and take them down until one of you runs away. What he's saying is don't resist violently. Don't mirror the evil of your attacker. Don't become the thing you hate. So that when Jesus says, don't antisthenai evil people, we need to rethink that. Walter Wink says that we should all go to our Bibles and open them up and cross out, do not resist that which is evil, and instead write in, do not react violently against the one who is evil. Do not react violently against the one who is evil. If we all had that correct translation, Walter Wink says, what a difference that would have made in Christian history. What Jesus is advocating here is not violent warfare, but neither is it passive resistance. What we have is a beautiful example of what has become to be known as Jesus' third way, a way that is both assertive and nonviolent, a way that pushes the whole world towards transformation while avoiding the temptation to just merely mirror that violence. I think I require for the rest of this work a volunteer. Martin. All right, Martin is going to come up here, and he actually did this in the first service. And Martin, I would like you to punch me. All right, now, Martin just gave me what one would consider a right hook, correct? Now, which one of my cheeks did he hit? The left. But if you refer to your little scripture handily printed in your order of service, it says if someone hits you on the right cheek. So how are you going to hit me on the right cheek? All right, problem. Why is there a problem? Martin just used his left hand to punch me in the right cheek, correct? In the ancient Near East, there is no such thing as toilet paper, which means people use their left hand to wipe their derrieres. And it is an act of profound shame upon you should you ever, under any circumstances, use your left hand in public. So you never ever would have hit my right cheek by using your left hand. So how would you hit my right cheek? Exactly, he would backhand me. Bear in mind that Martin in this scenario is a Roman imperial authority. I am one of Jesus' listeners, one of the Galilean peasants who has been hungering, starving, laboring for these Roman imperial authorities for years, for maybe my whole life. So it makes sense that on my right cheek, this big centurion guard is gonna backhand me, because that is the hit of a superior to an inferior then and now, right? So go ahead, Martin. All right, so he backhands me. And what does Jesus tell his followers to do? Turn the other cheek. And can you just see fire in his eyes saying that? Can you just imagine? So what happens now if I turn my other cheek? You have two possible ways to hit me. What's one way you could hit me? That is the punch of an equal to an equal. Now, if you're going to give me a proper backhand, what hand are you going to have to use? That's your poopy hand. And so either way you cut it, Jesus invites the oppressor to be complicit in his own shame. And the one being oppressed does not back down, even though he never reacts violently. All right, Martin, you're done. I need another volunteer. You're also going to be my Roman imperial guard. Anybody? All right, come on, Chris. This is the best one. Now, if you refer in your little text to what we have going on here, if someone wants to sue you and take your cloak, let him have your tunic as well. The background to this is that in the ancient Near East, there was a common practice that if you were in debt, someone could take you like to the equivalent of the courthouse steps in downtown Manassas and tell you, you owe me money, so I will take your cloak and wear it all around town to show people that you are indebted to me. So I am the impoverished little debtor, and you are my rich Roman imperial such and such who is going to sue me to take my cloak because I owe you money, right? So naturally enough, I'm gonna have to do a little costume change here. Naturally enough, you can have my cloak. And you can parade all around town and everybody knows that's my robe. And it's very clear to everybody that if you're wearing my robe, I am indebted to you. And what does Jesus tell his followers to do? Sure, you can take my cloak. Here. I'm not done. And then he says, is anyone horribly uncomfortable yet? Now imagine, you can work with me because, you know, you're not too creeped out, right, Chris? Imagine that the person doing this on the courthouse steps in front of 1,000 people is an emaciated, starving pauper with the marks of a whip all across his back. And when he takes off his tunic and hands it to the man to whom he is indebted, everyone sees those whip marks, and everybody sees that starving body, and this little man indebted to the big guy says with no words, you can take my clothes, but you cannot take my dignity. One more. I'll take my shoes back. One more volunteer. Anybody? All right, come on. So, the background to the last piece of this is that you know the ancient Roman army was, you know, the most organized, disciplined fighting force probably the history of the world has ever seen. And they needed to move across large distances very, very fast. One of the ways that they did that was as the Roman army trekked, you're going to be my Roman centurion, as the Roman army trekked from one place to another in ancient Galilee, they were legally permitted to indenture the citizenry of any town to carry their packs for 1 mile. And each mile, you would impress another person of the citizenry to carry your pack. The law was written such that the citizenry could carry your pack for 1 mile, not for more than 1 mile, for 1 mile. And if a centurion were to allow someone to carry their pack longer, you would be breaking military orders, right? So here you are, you're my Roman soldier, and you're marching along with your pack, and I take it as your little underling, and I carry it for 1 mile. And then I look at you and say, and I'm not giving it back. And how does that make you feel? She's like, why not? Because A, I'm not giving you back your stuff, and B, if I carry your pack for more than a mile, you're going to get in trouble with your superiors. Yeah. So, and I'm not giving it back because I'm your little pauper and I'm powerful too. So, you're all set. The reason I illustrate these things is because Jesus' behavior renders the superior impotent to instill shame in the subordinate. Jesus' behavior strips the power of the oppressor away from them. Gandhi said that the first principle of nonviolence is noncompliance with everything humiliating, and that's what Jesus does here. I will not comply with your degradation of me. I will not mirror your violence with more violence. I will neither back down nor stoop to your level. All of these are illustrations of an effective third way between violence and capitulation that teaches we are never completely powerless. Indeed, a sense of powerlessness has always been a spiritual disease deliberately produced by the powers that be to keep us complicit in our own subjugation. Anytime we feel we are powerless, we need to step back and we need to ask, for no one is completely powerless. In this season of hope, in this season of peace, we are invited, like the women in the midst of their torment in a concentration camp who bent spoons together to make an observation of the season, that we have the capacity to rebel. We are reminded that, like the ancient peasants of Galilee stripping bare the oppression of masters, we have an obligation to seek peace and to find it. We are not invited to do these things by passively laying down nor by mirroring violence to violence, but by ever seeking a third way, the power that comes when genuine peacefulness confronts the powers that be and changes the whole system such that it can never be the same again. And so may that peace, the truest peace of the season, be with you and among you this Christmas.